Rockbridge County, Virginia is steeped in history. A drive down Lexington's Main Street is like stepping back in time. So much so that Hollywood has utilized downtown as a movie set for Revolutionary War and Civil War era films. They just move the cars out and top up the roadways with dirt and they're ready to roll. Come along and join Gene Clark, Rockbridge County, Virginia Director of Tourism, for an engaging overview of cool things to do and see in the region. We'll stop in at the George C. Marshall Museum on the campus of VMI.
So the Marshall Plan, as Secretary of State, Marshall introduced this idea that the countries of Europe, after being ravaged and destroyed during World War II, would need some financial assistance to help get back on their feet and revive their economies and start to rebuild.
A visit at Stonewall Jackson's home.
We are the only site in town that can tell the story of a typical family prior to the American Civil War, and it's very much just like any family today.
We'll stop in at Washington and Lee University, where Robert E. Lee radically transformed America's university educational system.
The war was concluded at Appomattox in April of 1865. Lee came here as the 11th president in September of 1865.
We'll also visit Natural Bridge State Park that was long ago adored by and personally owned by Thomas Jefferson.
Jefferson really truly loved this place. In fact, some of his official portraits actually have the Natural Bridge in the background, and he did own the property for most of his life until he passed away, in fact. It's fantastic now that it's part of the state park system, so we can really tell all the stories, because there are a lot of stories to tell about the Natural Bridge.
Lexington, Virginia is home to the most historic Hampton Inn in America, as its centerpiece is an 1827 antebellum manor house.
Now, this is just not the typical Hampton Inn. This property originally was built in 1827 by one of the former governors of Virginia, James McDowell. And this was his home for his entire life. He was a pre-Civil War governor.
Hello, I'm Jean Clark, and I'm the Director of Tourism. We represent Rockbridge County, which includes the cities of Lexington and Buena Vista.
It sounds to me that Lexington is probably the first place that comes to mind,
the most iconic
and known.
You're right, it is. Probably for a number of reasons. Primarily, I would say, because of the two universities that are here, Virginia Military Institute and Washington and Lee University.
VMI is a legend in itself, it really is, and it's been around a long time.
VMI was founded in 1839, and before that it was an arsenal for the community, and the young men who worked there were so rowdy and got into trouble from time to time, and then it sort of morphed into this military college. You know, it's a state-supported military college. They have about 1,200 to 1,300 students. When their students graduate, they're represented in all four branches, and you can choose to be commissioned or not.
Oh, interesting. See, it's not like you have to make a commitment or you don't have to choose a branch ahead of time.
That's exactly right, yeah.
In my mind, it's unique in that it's not West Point, it's not Annapolis, it's not a government entity. This is a state-run military institute. Are there others around the country?
The Citadel.
That's about it.
Uh-huh, that's correct, yeah.
Do most of the kids come from Virginia, or do they come from all around everywhere?
They come from all over. They have international students as well. I would say probably the greatest percentage of them come from Virginia, just simply because of the tuition issue. Mm-hmm. But they do have a lot of international students, and then they do come from all over.
Going back in time, not even that far back, you have some very famous legendary graduates, World War II.
George C. Marshall, sort of the unsung hero. Sometimes you'll talked about George C. Marshall, and people look at you like, who is that? But, you know, he was a real hero, and he's...
And I think it's much post-war. I mean, the Marshall Plan, that was huge in shaping our world.
That's exactly right.
We're here with Jeffrey Kozak, archivist and assistant librarian at the George C. Marshall Foundation. And we're right on the campus of a very legendary military-oriented university.
Yes, we're on the post at the Virginia Military Institute.
How did the foundation come to be placed here?
George C. Marshall, who is the namesake of the Marshall Foundation, was a cadet at the Virginia Military Institute right around the turn of the century. So just as an homage, Marshall really felt that the experiences he had and the education he gained at the Virginia Military Institute set him up for success later in his career. And so just to honor the influence that his experience at Virginia Military Institute had on his life, it was deemed that this would be an appropriate place to celebrate Marshall's life and his achievements.
I'm a little biased, but when I think back on World War II and even post-World War II, I hold in the highest esteem George C. Marshall. I mean, you have to honor Eisenhower and all the Army field commanders, but as a brain trust, as a brilliant man that made a difference in the entire 20th century, I think it's him.
Yes, that's great to hear, and that's certainly the perspective we have here at the Marshall Foundation. The most interesting aspect of Marshall's life, though, is that he was not a big self-promoter. He didn't want to be in the forefront and in the spotlight. He preferred to work behind the scenes. And so this is why Marshall's name, when it comes up in relation to the war and to the work he did in the post-war, it's not as much of a household name as a name like an Eisenhower or a MacArthur or a Patton would be. But you're absolutely correct. The work that he did, even though he wasn't out in the field leading armies, was essential to helping the U.S. and also the Allies achieve victory in World War II.
And post-victory, I think that's the biggest, most profound thing that made a huge difference in the 20th century, in our lives even today. And that was the Marshall Plan.
Yeah. So the Marshall Plan, as Secretary of State, Marshall introduced this idea that the countries of Europe, after being ravaged and destroyed during World War II, would need some financial assistance to help get back on their feet and revive their economies and start to rebuild. So Marshall brought this proposal that if the European countries would get together and decide what their need was, the U.S. would provide the funding to help these countries rebuild. This was just a great idea on Marshall's behalf. It really helped to alter U.S. foreign policy and change the direction from previously being very isolationist to starting to take a more active role, and also just to realize that things that are happening overseas do have an impact on what's going on in the U.S. as well. So that was important.
Has there been any intellectual exercises, a what if? What if there had not been a Marshall Plan? And how would have Europe post-World War II evolved or devolved?
It's very much has always been a question of kind of those counterfactuals of what may have happened if the Marshall Plan had not been funded or if it had not succeeded as it was intended. And there is very much the threat. The Marshall Plan was very much a response to the spread of communism into Europe. And there's the assumption that had the U.S. decided not to intervene and try to help its allies in Europe, then communism would have basically taken over the European continent.
And here on campus at VMI, to come and experience the Marshall Museum of his life and actions, what are the highlights, the things that you'd want somebody to be sure not to miss?
You'd certainly want to see the Jeep that we have. Marshall was very instrumental in the development of the Jeep. It became a very well-known icon of World War II. And so just to learn Marshall's story and his leadership in getting the Jeep produced for the Army is great. We also have Marshall's Nobel Peace Prize, which he was awarded for his work on the Marshall Plan. And he received that in 1953. And that's his actual real medal is on display in the museum, so that's definitely something that would be worth seeing.
Very cool. It has been a pleasure to visit with you, Jeff Kozak, archivist and assistant librarian at the George C. Marshall Foundation on the campus of VMI, Virginia.
Thank you so much for coming by.
My pleasure and honor. Thank you.
Stonewall Jackson, Thomas Jonathan Jackson, was pre-war, pre-Civil War. And so he's also legendary at the school as well.
Yeah, so he went to VMI?
He taught at VMI.
Wow.
He taught at VMI, as did Matthew Fontaine Maury, who, you know, charted the seas. Right on the bank in front of VMI on Main Street was the home of Virginia's Governor Letcher. So lots of connections there at VMI that tied it back. And to this day, you know, VMI has a real strong alumni group. You know, if you're a VMI graduate, somebody's going to take care of you somewhere.
That's so cool. You're not going to fall through the cracks.
Correct.
Yeah. Back in time, back to Stonewall Jackson and the Institute and whatnot, that is symbolic of where we are in American history. we're far to the north, but we're still in the south. And Stonewall Jackson, for him, it wasn't an easy decision which side to go on.
That's correct. And, you know, here we have the only home he ever owned. His horse is on display in the VMI Museum, the rain jacket he was wearing when he was wounded, instruments he used when he taught at VMI, and then the cemetery where he and his family are buried.
So truly living history.
Yeah. And we have the man, the horse he rode in on, and his resting place.
Grace of Lee, the site director at the Stonewall Jackson House in Virginia. So you're pretty familiar with Stonewall Jackson, aren't you? Because you relive his life every day.
I do, yes. And I've been here for 10 years, so I've gotten to know him over those 10 years.
In some ways, you really do know him. You can kind of hear his voice or how he might think, react, or act.
Close sometimes. I've studied a lot of his life here in Lexington is really my expertise in getting to know him and his family.
So you can have a sense of him walking down the street to go to VMI or walking around town. You can almost see him turning a corner, huh?
Absolutely.
His formal name, he's known in history as Stonewall Jackson for standing there like a stone wall.
Yes, sir.
But before that, he was Thomas, right?
He was. His full name is Thomas Jonathan Jackson, and actually the citizens of Lexington at the time would have known him as Major Jackson. That was his rank when he taught over at the Virginia Military Institute.
Up until the time of the start of the Civil War, he was an instructor at the VMI, the Virginia Military Institute.
He taught what was then called natural and experimental philosophy, but we know it better today as physics.
From a familial standpoint, when the Civil War started, he had a really tough choice to make because he was a staunch unionist at heart.
He was. A lot of the citizens of Lexington actually were very pro-union, and his view was he really felt that if the states had a disagreement that they should figure that out as a union. But he also was a Virginian. Many people at that time viewed themselves as a Virginian first or Pennsylvanian first.
What's really profound about that, he was a Virginian first over family.
Well, yes, and I assume you're referring to his sister, Laura. Mm-hmm. His sister lived in what is today Beverly, West Virginia. It was still part of Virginia then.
But they were very, very close.
They were very close. And Jackson, I think, actually made the assumption that his sister would support Virginia seceding from the Union. But he found that when he went to fight for the Confederacy, she was very pro-Union, and their relationship ended as a result of being on opposite sides of the war. And before his death in 1863, they never reconciled.
Interesting. Going back in time, Stonewall Jackson, Thomas Jackson, was a very staunch supporter of states' rights. Have you studied or read any nuances about that specific relative to Thomas?
Specifically to Jackson, he was very states' right.
Did that have anything to do with slavery, do you think, or not?
There is one quote, and I don't have it off the top of my head, but he is talking specifically about states' rights with slavery, but his opinions on slavery, his writings are just so few that we don't have enough information to give on fully how he felt about slavery.
Interesting. Somebody came here today and they came to his house, they could get a real sense of what their life was like back in time. You have some of their original furniture and a lot of things that you would have stepped into their house 1860 and you would have found here.
Absolutely. Because we have a lot of these original artifacts, we want to tell a true story of Jackson. So that's the good and the bad. Jackson as a professor, a husband, a family man, but also Jackson as a slave owner and a man who did make mistakes throughout his life.
So he was struck down in 1863, right?
That's correct. He was wounded at the Battle of Chancellorsville on May 2nd, 1863, and died 8 days later.
And I think the real disconnect of that, it was friendly fire.
It was. He was shot by friendly fire, and he was wounded 3 times, twice in the left arm, once in the right hand. To save his life, they amputated his left arm, and they believed he would make a full recovery, but he never did.
And that's another classic case of disease and germs and whatnot, and not the wound itself.
Absolutely. And for a long time, it was believed he had pneumonia, but many people today believe he actually had blood poisoning from being dropped so many times on the way off the battlefield.
Wow. So here we are, Lexington, Virginia, right in the heart of town. So in your opinion and mine, this would be a must-see.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful community. It's a wonderful town. And specifically with the Jackson House, we are the only site in town that can tell the story of a typical family prior to the American Civil War. And it's very much just like any family today.
So much more so than just a Civil War general.
Absolutely. We tell much more the personal side of Jackson.
A family side, yeah.
Yes, sir.
And their garden out back.
Absolutely.
All right, Grace, thank you so much for sharing. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Yeah. For further information,
stonewalljackson.org.
Let's talk a little bit more about this county as a destination.
Well, the one thing we haven't talked about is Washington Lee University. You talked about VMI being really old. Washington Lee is about 90 years older. It was founded in 1749. It started out as a small school in Augusta County north of us, moved a couple times, finally got, you know, into the Lexington area. Had a campus just on the west side of town. They had fire there, so then they moved it onto the present campus, and it was a small men's college prior to the Civil War. And then during the war, they had so many students who had left the area and couldn't afford to come back, and that's when a local judge rode to Richmond and asked Robert E. Lee if he would consider coming here to be president of the university. So the judge had to borrow a horse, I think, and a suit, and went to Richmond and made the pitch.
Hi, I'm Lucy Wilkins. I'm the director of University Collections and Lee Chaplin Museum.
Nice. It truly is living Americana history.
It really is, because our school spans American history, since it's the ninth oldest school in the United States.
This school, its roots go back to Revolutionary era,
yes,
don't they?
Actually, pre-Revolutionary.
Yeah, wow. Right? So really the true roots of America.
It really is, since the first settlers came out here to the Valley of Virginia in the 1730s. And then the little Augusta Academy was formed in 1749. And then we have been here pretty much ever since.
And it's had some different incarnations, and at some point it became Washington University?
A Washington College.
Washington College, and that was in honor of our first president.
Yes, because Washington gave the largest gift at that time ever given to institution of higher education in 1796 to what was then Liberty Hall Academy, and then they changed their name to thank him to Washington College.
Up until the time of the Civil War, it remained fairly small college, didn't it?
Yes, and it was, of course, all male. And it was just a small liberal arts school that was a little bit different than most universities of the period, which had been formed to train ministers. This school has never been that case. It's always been a non-sectarian school.
So at some point, there was a major shift in this school, and that had to do with the post-Civil War in Robert E. Lee.
Yes. The school was about to go under when Lee got here. There was no money. The student population was down because of the war, and also it had just been sort of kept alive as a preparatory school during the war. So they were down to 40 students. It would have been easy for them to give up at that point, but we had a very courageous group of trustees, and they came on the bright idea of asking the famous General Robert E. Lee to be their 11th president.
And this was literally months after the conclusion of the Civil War.
That's correct. Of course, we all know that the war was concluded at Appomattox in April of 1865. Lee came here as the 11th president in September of 1865.
And that was a real unstable time for people, Southerners. Jefferson Davis was imprisoned at that time, and there were other generals who were living in fear of being arrested and imprisoned. And he might have thought that same thing himself when he came here, correct?
Well, he certainly thought there was a chance he could be tried as a traitor, and he had given his oath of allegiance, but he had entered also his request for citizenship, but it had not been granted. So he wasn't really sure where he stood at that particular point. The state of Virginia was also not a state at that point. It was Military District Number 1.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah. So this was Reconstruction.
So moving forward in Reconstruction, there were many Southerners who were willing to move on and do their best to heal the wounds and reform the Union as a whole. Where did Lee fit in that scope?
Lee really set the tone for that, because there were many who were having trouble readjusting and were very bitter over their losses. But Lee felt he had to set the example, and he did. He tried very hard to communicate to his former soldiers that they needed to also establish their oath to go back to their farms and to become productive citizens of the United States. He wanted the state of Virginia, he wanted the school to look forward, not backward.
So let's move forward in time during his tenure as the head here at the university. And he truly was a visionary in American college, university, academia, and how it propelled forward.
This is the story that most people don't know, because most of us, you know, our knowledge of Lee ends at Appomattox. But as president here, he managed to create something that all of us have benefited from. He put his faculty to trying to find out what was the latest in educational theory, and they came up with an idea that had been tried unsuccessfully before the war, but Lee and his faculty managed to make it actually work, and that was the whole idea of majors and electives. So when all of us have gone to college and have decided on what major or what area of life we wanted to pursue and have our own choices, this was something that was invented here at Washington and Lee. It had not been done before. Lee brought in 9 new departments. He called them departments, not majors, but 9 new majors into the school, created a school of journalism, a school of law, and a school of business.
This was the first school of journalism in the United States, correct?
That's correct. No one had thought that journalists needed 4 years of college education, but he thought so, and he gave them a scholarship and then also a job at the local newspaper while they were students here.
That's pretty profound, isn't it?
It is amazing.
Yeah. That was a model that was replicated by Harvard, and then off from there, right?
Yes, it started the University of Georgia, copied what they did here, then the University of Virginia, and then Harvard. Since it has spread to our entire country, and you think how many students from all over the world have benefited from the education that we offer here in the United States, it's a huge legacy, bigger than anything Lee accomplished in the Civil War.
Let's talk horse for a moment. Traveler was Robert E. Lee's horse that he loved probably as much as anything in the world.
Yes. Well, Traveler was originally called Jefferson Davis, believe it or not. Lee acquired him in 1862, and they were just about in every battle together during the war. Traveler was a very high-spirited horse. He was tall, 16 hands high. Lee was kind of short in the leg and tall in the body, so he looked great on Traveler. They made quite a pair. When Lee brought him here to Lexington, Traveler was allowed to graze all over the college grounds. He took a ride on Traveler just about every afternoon all over the county here, and they became very close.
And like you were alluding to earlier, he, like a lot of others, basically were going through PTSD, and Traveler literally became a source of solace for him.
Well, as historians, we can't say that he had PTSD, because no one, of course, would call it back then.
Sure.
But surely Lee was suffering emotionally just from the carnage of that horrible war and of having to have send so many young men to their deaths. So it is just my personal opinion that those afternoon rides with Traveler helped Lee heal from the scars of the war.
Wasn't he quoted as saying something to that effect?
He did say that in a letter. He said, Traveler and I have sweet communion as we go into the mountains.
But then he did not live that long after the Civil War.
That's correct. Lee died in 1870, only 5 years after he became president here. And he accomplished quite a lot. He established the basis for our current honor system. He completely redid the curriculum, and he restored the grounds, which had been damaged by a raid here in 1864, set the tone that the university and the goals of being on the cutting edge of the modern sciences. Since then, the school is still on the paths that he set out.
So here we are today. After a century, it's coeducational.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Finally, at last.
And what's it known for today? Why
I think two things, a largely undergraduate school of business. We do produce a lot of business majors. And then the law school. It's a small law school, but is consistently in the top 25 in the nation.
And it's all privately funded?
Yes, it is a private school. We have a wonderful group of trustees who and a very supportive staff and administration. I hope people will come and see us and really not just accept the things that they hear about the 19th century, but to really learn about it and to learn about the people involved and remember that they're all people and they certainly all had their good points and bad points. My name is Lucy Wilkins. I am the Director of University Collections and the Site Manager for Lee Chaplin Museum at Washington and Lee University.
And so you talk about George C. Marshall post-World War II, and it's Robert E. Lee post-Civil War. So it was Jackson prior to the war and Lee after the Civil War.
It'd be fascinating to live at any time in history here.
It sure would be, yeah.
That is, for a lot of us, again, a reason to come here. And even the architecture.
Exactly.
I mean, the hotel I'm staying in is like 1820. Yeah.
Which hotel are you staying in?
It's a Hampton Inn.
Okay, yeah.
But
yeah.
That's not fair to call it that because that's not what would come to mind the reality.
Isn't it lovely?
This, I think in all of America, that's nobody would ever imagine where they would arrive in this antebellum brick mansion.
George Moore, General Manager, Hampton Inn, Lexington, Virginia.
George, I got to admit, when I rolled up, I was not expecting what I found. When I thought I'm staying at a Hampton Inn, you know what I thought. And here, it's an antebellum mansion. Tell us about that disconnect and how that came to be within the Hampton family.
Well, that's a common reaction amongst our guests when they pull up. They really can't believe that it's a Hampton Inn. Sometimes they even drive right by it.
I would have done that.
Yeah, thinking that, you know, this is just not the typical Hampton Inn. This property originally was built in 1827 by one of the former governors of Virginia, James McDowell. And this was his home for his entire life. He was a pre-Civil War governor. And this property has been through, I believe it's 15 different families through all the years. The last family, the Mason family, that actually had a member of the family living here passed away, I think, in the mid-1950s. In her will, she left it to Washington Lee University, but they never used it for anything. As a matter of fact, they didn't even live up to the stipulations of the will, which was to maintain it and to use it as the residence for the president of the college. But they never did.
Interesting. So it just sat there and languished.
Yeah. It sat here and it really deteriorated quite a bit over the years. And then when the property came up for sale for us, it was in pretty bad shape. As a matter of fact, most people that looked at it, they looked at it and said, no thanks. But the owners that bought this property, they saw the potential for it. They were already looking for a place to put a Hampton Inn. Then they saw this property and thought, why not make use of the house as well? So we really have a wide repertoire of guest facilities here where you can experience a historical house. We have 10 guest rooms here in the manor house. Or you can opt for the normal Hampton Inn rooms, and the building is attached by way of a breezeway. And we also have a meeting space that can accommodate up to 200 people.
I would presume that you would pay a premium to stay in the historic house.
Yes, you do, just a little bit. Not much. It's usually ranges from like a $20 to $40 difference between the two room types.
That's not much.
No, not really. And then, of course, we have the log cabin that's out back.
Oh, yeah, I saw that out there. What is the story on that? That's like a romance room? Or?
Well, a lot of people like to think that, but it predates the manor house. So we had the logs dated to like the late 1700s. And when we bought the property here, there was no foundation on it. The logs were resting right on the ground. So it was literally rotting from the ground up. So we took the log cabin down, log by log, put a modern foundation in. Now it has air conditioning and heating and all that good stuff. And we put one our boardroom in there. So there's a boardroom, and there's a kitchen and a restroom.
So nobody can spend the night there?
No, can't spend the night in there.
I would change that. I think that'd be great.
I think it would be, too. It'd be a nice feature. But the owners decided to do this instead.
It's so wonderful that it did get saved.
As a matter of fact, another difference between this Hampton Inn and others is that we have 8 acres of land here. In a city setting, that's unusual.
Yeah, I'll say that's extraordinary. And that all dates back to McDowell and
yes.
Because of their homestead?
Originally, there were 600 acres with this property. And through the years, of course, got sold off and divided up. And so now we're left with 8 acres.
Little off subject, but how did McDowell make his fortune? And how did he come to be so influential in Virginia?
That's a good question. He was a politician, of course.
Oh, okay. Well, that explains it.
Yeah. And this was never like an operating plantation. This was an estate. And he bought this property from his father. How his father got his money, I'm not sure.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What a joy and what a surprise.
Thank you very much. I hope you enjoy your stay with us.
And, you know, that building was actually given to Washington and Lee to be used as a president's home. But the president of the college still lives in the house that General Lee had built for his family. And they never did move, you know, the president's home from the front campus of Washington and Lee across town to where you're spending the night. Mm-hmm. Eventually, kept saying, if you're not going to use this, it was just storage. This desk we're sitting at right here was an old desk out of one of the offices at Washington and Lee, and that's where they left their, like, their out of goods, things they didn't want anymore.
Right.
So one day we went over and we bought a couple desks and a file cabinet for about $25, you know, and the place was kind of
cobwebby.
Yeah, and the plaster was falling in the front hall. And so about that time, then they started talking about a way to make that part of our city landscape and how they could bring more lodging in here to accommodate both the colleges and the Virginia Horse Center and our tourism industry.
That's so cool. So you can stay in this beautiful old pre-Civil War mansion, or I guess if you chose, one of the more typical Hampton Inn units in the backside.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Okay, now we got to jump forward into time to the here and now. So somebody coming and traveling around the region, why would they come here? Why would you say today to come here? What would be, you know, priority? Would it be architecture, food, culture? What would
it be? It would have to be all of those. And you know, a lot of people who have my position are looking for product to promote.
Right.
You know, I've had friends in other communities who have to develop product, whether it's a wine trail or a river trail. Mm-hmm. We have so much here to offer that it'd be hard to narrow down and answer that question.
Yeah. But that's cool. Because you're not going to have anybody get bored.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, on the south end of our county, we have the famous Natural Bridge that was, you know, owned by Thomas Jefferson. Actually, this year we're going to celebrate the 250th anniversary of his first visit to the Natural Bridge. Right. Allegedly surveyed by George Washington, is now the Natural Bridge State Park. That's on the south end of Rottenbridge County.
We're with Katie Charles, park naturalist, at a new state park.
Absolutely. You're here at Natural Bridge State Park here in Rockbridge County, Virginia. We've only been a state park since September 24th of last year, which was actually National Public Lands Day.
And it's fascinating because this probably in some respects should have been a state park going back forever. Thomas Jefferson fell in love with this place.
Jefferson really, truly loved this place. In fact, some of his official portraits actually have the Natural Bridge in the background, and he did own the property for most of his life until he passed away, in fact. It's fantastic now that it's part of the state park system, so we can really tell all the stories, because there are a lot of stories to tell about the Natural Bridge.
That's so cool. Tell us about, one, where you're located and accessing.
Luckily, we are a pretty easy to access state park. We are off of exit either 175 or 180 on Interstate 81. So Rockbridge County, Virginia, kind of right in the center of Virginia.
Okay. So how far to Roanoke or Washington, D.C., for example?
We're going to be about a three-hour drive from Washington, D.C.
That's not bad.
Not bad at all. A great day trip. We definitely recommend it. And also, if you live in Roanoke, if you live in Lynchburg, or even in the Stanton-Waynesboro area, we're just about an hour's drive.
Mm-hmm. I noticed as we were leaving the park headquarters, there was a beautiful hotel. Tell us about that.
There is a hotel right across the street. Historically, the Natural Bridge, the hotel, and caverns were all one property. Now that we're a state park, the hotel and caverns do operate separately, but we definitely have a great working relationship with them. So if you're looking for some overnight accommodations, we do have some right across the street.
So that would be the most logistically perfect.
Yeah. Absolutely. And of course, come back and see us in the future, and we'll definitely have some campgrounds.
So for now, tell us about what somebody would see and experience here.
Well, there's definitely a lot of things to experience at Natural Bridge. Of course, the most obvious, walking our nature path down to the Natural Bridge. Coming up this summer, we are going to have a stargazing event night. That's going to be on June 24th. So you can come out and actually stay the night, camp out on the property and view the stars, because, man, we've got some beautiful sky out here.
A little detail on the Natural Bridge. What it is, how tall it is, how dramatic it is.
So when you come to visit Natural Bridge State Park, when you see our stone arch, it is limestone, 215 feet tall, and you'll get a chance to actually walk underneath of it and through it and view it from both sides.
And there's a river that runs through it.
Yes, and of course the river that actually created the Natural Bridge that carved out the rock over the years is Cedar Creek, and you'll be walking along that for the entire trail.
Once you get down to the bridge, and then there's trails that go on from there. We're way downstream from the bridge right now.
Absolutely. So Cedar Creek Trail, the trail that passes right underneath the stone arch, that's going to take you, if you go all the way to the end, it's going to take you a mile from the gift shop all the way out to Lace Waterfall. And just remember, it's an out and back trail, so as far as you walk out, you're walking the same distance.
I was wondering whether it was a giant loop or what.
Being down in the ravine with our creek, unfortunately no space for a loop, but it just means you get to see all the beautiful things twice.
And tell us about flora and fauna.
Oh my goodness, so many neat things to see here. We have ravens that actually nest underneath the Natural Bridge. We're about as far south in Virginia as you're usually going to see ravens. You may get a chance to see our river otter or even a mink as you walk along the creek, and beautiful butterflies in the spring and summertime, just pretty much everywhere along the trail.
What type of butterflies?
We have our state butterfly, which is going to be the tiger swallowtail. I see dozens of those every time I'm on the trail. Also, a very interesting species of swallowtail butterfly, it's the zebra swallowtail. They only lay their eggs on pawpaw trees, which we have plenty of them down here on the trail as well. So some beautiful butterflies and lots of fritillaries and a couple other species down here as well.
So if you had a friend coming out and they'd never been here before, what would be your hit list of what they should do and see?
Well, of course, the first thing is you want to come down and actually stand underneath the Natural Bridge. You really don't know how tall 215 feet is until you're standing directly underneath of it. Of course, catching a raindrop or two on your head from the water dripping under the bridge. And I definitely say walk all the way out to the waterfall. If you're able to do it, if you can make your way all the way out there, Lace Waterfall it's not very tall, only about 35, 40 feet, but the way it flows over, it actually looks like a lace dress or a lace veil. Got to go and see that.
Very cool. Well, Katie Charles, park naturalist, Virginia State Parks, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Hopefully we'll see you all soon.
Yeah, I don't want to leave.
Well, don't worry. We got plenty more trails for you.
North end, you have the mill where Cyrus McCormick invented the reaper that revolutionized, you know, agriculture. Mm-hmm. On the way to that, you're going to pass by Sam Houston's birthplace. On the eastern edge of the county, we have the Blue Ridge Parkway and the Appalachian Trail running along the mountains. And on the western end of the county, we have this beautiful Goshen Pass that brings you from Western Virginia and West Virginia through a mountain gorge.
I just went there 3 hours ago through the little town of Goshen.
And you came through the pass?
Yeah, and the river. And
was the rhododendron in bloom?
I think so. I was looking at the trees and the water. Yeah.
Isn't it a special place, though?
Oh, it really is. You want to stop at every 5 minutes.
You do.
We did a couple times.
So that's the perimeter of Wrightbridge County. Mm-hmm. And then you have the two cities, Lexington, which has the universities, Washington Lee, VMI, the Virginia Horse Center, which is a equestrian facility just outside of Lexington.
And is that open to the public? Somebody just stop in and watch the horses?
Anytime you want to, absolutely. There aren't horses permanently stabled there. Well, I'll take that back. They do have a therapeutic riding group at the back end of the property there. But in terms of if you stopped in and said, hey, I want to take a little gallop here, there's not going to be a horse for you to do that on.
Got it. But typically there's something going on there.
Yes. Yeah. They have, golly, I want to say about 400 events a year there.
Oh, wow.
And then Buena Vista on the eastern edge of Rutledge County, the other city, has Southern Virginia University, has an affiliation with the Church of Latter-day Saints. And they have a growing student enrollment there.
Is it a college or what?
It is. Mm-hmm. And it's nestled right in the, you know, edge of the Blue Ridge with the Maury River going right through it.
Talking about all these cool outdoor things, it would be a place where somebody could get a bunk here in town but spend all their time trout fishing or hiking.
They could.
Yeah.
They could do that. Mm-hmm. Or they could spend a lot of time in museums and learning about the history of the area. And they could spend some time in some restaurants where we have some great farm-to-table experiences.
You know, I was just ahead of you in my mind because I'm hungry.
And
I was just thinking about what type of food would be regional specialty here.
Well, you know, you did mention that we are just south of the Mason-Dixon line. And so while, you know, we do have a variety of food, probably one of the things that people always ask about is, you know, just like you did, what's something you would expect here? The Southern Inn restaurant right in the center of town, which has been in business since the 1930s, has this fried chicken that you cannot beat.
Can we go there?
I think you're going to go there tomorrow night.
All right. I'm going to order fried chicken.
Yeah, I hope you will.
Yeah, I definitely will.
My name is Jean Clark. I'm the director of tourism here in Lexington, Virginia. Want to learn more about us? Go to lexingtonvirginia.com. Virginia spelled out, no abbreviation, no punctuation. Lexingtonvirginia.com.
Cool. Well, I'm glad I came.
I'm glad you did too. Thanks for coming.
You're welcome. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Virginia. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.